Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back. A little delay from the True Blue LA podcast. Eric, Steven, you and I both waited until there was news, and boy, did we wait.
Yeah, and to be fair, there was a chance, there was like a small window where we could have recorded something on the Russell Martin trade, but they're like, just didn't work out. So we waited and waited, and hey, look, we have Dodgers signed a free agent outfielder, just like we all expected.
Yeah, I think the one I actually think it probably was the one I was expecting.
We mentioned it, I think, you know, going over scenarios like in previous podcasts, like, you know, while Bryce Harper has always been sort of the white whale or whatever out there, and like, you know, they're Dodgers rumored interested in all this stuff, but it always seemed like AJ Pollock like made sense, but then it almost had to be like a combination, like Pollock and then maybe some other move, like, you know, that could be like a noteworthy offseason, but they're still like pieces. They haven't done that other big move yet, and like so we're
you know, pitchers and catchers are reporting pretty soon.
Yeah, like in like 2 weeks, basically. Like, it's pretty crazy. Like today's the 29th, right? Like, yeah, like that. Wait, 28 today. Yeah. So like, man, in what, 16 days, Dodgers pitchers and catchers report. So, I mean, they basically have the team set. Like, there's still rumors.
You know what, though?
We'll get into it. Yeah,
of pitchers and catchers, of the moves left to make, it's likely to be one of those two, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, like we the
Not
other
that they pipe have to report by that date, but
pipe dream is like you know, we mentioned Harper, and then also like, well, what about trading for like Corey Kluber or like America's sweetheart Trevor Bauer or something like from the Indians? But it doesn't seem like the Indians are all that keen to trade one of those guys right now, and so that's maybe out the window. But there's still like this JT Realmuto is still out there. I know the Dodgers like traded for Russell Martin, but it's like,
Well, they also traded for a gentleman named Jeter, and I wonder if the ego of the other Jeter is just that was setting up the deal.
Oh man, like
one for one swap.
Yeah, one for one. Yeah, Jeter Downs infielder in the that was in the Reds salary dump trade. So yeah, like that would be amazing. Like, or at least throw him in. Like, look, Jeter, here's your Jeter, and then you know you can also look. We all know like. If they do this deal, like you figure one of the catchers is going, and like maybe even Austin Barnes too. So like, and then and Jeter Downs, like that'll seal the deal. So who knows, man? Like they might be done, they might not be, but yeah. So that's sort of where we're at. But yeah, so the big signing, AJ Pollock.
Let's start big to small. We'll get into the trade rumors a little bit more, I think.
Yeah. So if you. I don't know. I haven't actually looked to see if the numbers bear this out, but it seemed like AJ Pollock was one of those guys who, you know, I know Paul Goldschmidt got the lion's share of like, dear God, his numbers against the Dodgers are crazy, you know, outside of against Pedro Baez, which was weird. But like AJ Pollock always seemed like one of those guys who hit like 750 against the Dodgers somehow.
I'll look at it while you talk.
This is one of those like addition by subtraction kind of a thing just in that regard. But like, I don't know. Like, so he, the Pollock story is weird because, so last year, like I would say until like the first week of May, AJ Pollock was like the best hitter in baseball. I think, he had like a crazy start, won the player of the month in April. He was hitting like a billion, so, okay, I can tell you this, May 14th, 293, 349, 620 with 11 home runs. I think he hit nine of those in April. And then he broke his left thumb, which is sort of the AJ Pollock story. And then he missed 7 weeks, and then he barely did anything the rest of the way. Like, he had a 297 on base the rest of the season, and he just was, like, ordinary. But so, like, with him, it seems like you know, injury history, like, is his sort of calling card, and the Dodgers were kind of downplaying it. Like, Andrew Friedman was saying, well, he really hasn't, he's had, like, one, like, soft tissue injury. They've all been, like, breaks, but so, you know, injury prone is injury prone, I think, in some cases. So, 2014, fractured his right hand, he missed 3 months. 2016, fractured right elbow, he missed almost 5 months. I'm trying to remember, I can't remember 2014 or 2016 was the one where he was like sliding into home plate, like either like on a spring training game or like really, it was like, oh man, how do you get injured on that? You know, like it was very bad. But anyway, strained right groin in 2017, he missed 2.5 months. And then last year, the thumb, 7 weeks. So you basically look at it, 6 full years in the majors. He's averaged like 101 games, I think, in those 6 years, so that's not good. He had one like full year, really good year, 2015. Since then, he's just been kind of like slightly above average, which is good, but not great. And then brings like above average defense in center field, which is something the Dodgers needed, I think. So, you know, I think it's one of those like if he's healthy and productive, great. But like, there's no real reason to expect him to be healthy, so. And I don't know, but that's what they got. So yeah, so the deal, what is it? 5 years. It's technically like a 4-year contract, for $55 million. But there's a player option for a fifth year with like a buyout attached. So in this, for the luxury tax, it's like 5 years, $60 million.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's interesting. So I. There are some like for me, he can also opt out at the end of 3 years if he has like enough plate appearances, which he, if history is any guide, he won't get there. Like he needs like 1,000 plate appearances in those last in 2021 or 1450 for the first 3 years. And like he hasn't done that the last 3 years. So, you know, who knows? But like my favorite part, there's like these escalator clauses for his player option. But anyway, so back then, if he does get that, reach those thresholds, like it's essentially, he gets the buyout of his option anyway. So like, it's essentially like a 3-year, $45 million deal in that case. So mm-hmm. that's kind of where he's at. But like my favorite part of the whole contract is this. There's like escalator clauses for that player option, which is right now it's a 10 million player option with a $5 million buyout. So the 5 million is, you know, he gets that no matter what. But if he wins an MVP award in any of these 4 years, he has like this point system, but he gets that base salary for that option year gets added 5 million. So if he wins 4 MVPs and then also reaches 600 plate appearances in 2022, his 2023 player option is $35 million.
So, at that point, what steal?
Yeah, exactly. Like who'd walk away from $35 million? Who knows? But although that said, he'd be in a pretty strong negotiating point to go be a free agent after 4 straight MVPs. So who knows?
This deal just strikes me as a very typical Friedman move. A agile move, I think is what I'm going to call it. Just very, you know, sort of locks in a guy flexible. There's an opt-out. It's center field, which he doesn't necessarily have positional flexibility, but center field is the hardest one of the outfield positions, the hardest to kind of flex into for your other very sort of movable pieces. It hits their belief, clearly, at least in my mind, that depth is a market inequity, and that it allows you to take on these sort of Rich Hill, Pollock-esque, well, they're only going to give us 120 games, but maybe those will be really good games, and we've got the depth to sort of absorb that. It strikes me everything there, but at a certain point when you lose 2 World Series in a row and you're raising ticket prices, there's this sort of, whether it's fair or not, perceived or not, whatever it is, sort of smug satisfaction to kind of just sit on your laurels, keep running things out, and keep hoping for the best. And fair or not, a large portion of the fan base is not happy about that. Do you want to talk about the Stan Carson interview?
Yeah, and so you're right, though, about the depth thing. Like, it is, like, weird, and you completely understand why fans would be upset, because essentially, like, this trade, like, you know, they talked about bringing balance. He's a right-handed hitting outfielder. But the Dodgers traded 2 right-handed hitting outfielders, like, earlier in the offseason. So it's like they made the hole they needed to fill.
I want to rein in, because I saw you tweeting about it. I want to rein that in just a little bit. Because remember, sure, one of those guys is a guy you thought they were going to salary dump a year ago.
Oh, yeah, no question.
So, like, I basically view them as they traded someone they – I basically viewed it, they swapped 1 year of Puig, who they didn't want in the center field, for someone they do want in center field at 3 or 4 years.
No, it's completely, like, valid in that regard. And, like yeah, you're right. Like, and it's not so much Kemp, because we saw he faded in the second half. Like, same issues as before. Like, what does he really bring? He's not, you know, they were trying to dump that salary no matter what. So, but that said, so you're essentially, you traded away like a fan favorite in Puig, yes, and that's where the fan hire comes. But then at the same time, you're right. Like, it's 1 year of Puig or like 5 years of Pollock, or, you know, maybe it's 4 or 3 even, but like, and someone who can actually play center field. And, but it, you know, it might be even like a wash from a baseball standpoint, but like, you're right. It sets them up a little bit better.
It sets them up a little bit better, but as you said, the optics, geez,
it's weird,
term,
yeah,
is not very good. And you can get away with that if you're going to sign a Bryce Harper. And I have such a weird relationship with the Dodgers fans' desire to sign Harper, because I've never been that. He's the guy that I'm suspicious of giving an 8-year contract, just based on how he's played, that sort of his defensive metrics, that his offensive numbers actually haven't been, in my mind, at least 8-year plus deal worthy. But at the same time, I really want this team to do something exciting and to kind of reinvigorate that, hey, this is a front office and an ownership, specifically an ownership, that will do what it takes to push us over the edge, over 2 to 3 teams in the AL that are, I think, in my mind, just better than Dodgers, and potentially significantly so.
Yeah, and like, before I get into that, I just want to go back. You said you called this move like an agile move, and I kind of agree with that. And for some reason in my head, I just wanted to say the word sinewy, and so maybe this deal is a sinewy. But no, yeah, you're right. Like, here's the deal. Like, Sandcast and what we're going to talk about a little bit is, so again, I wasn't there Saturday, but yeah, there was a press conference for Pollock at FanFest, and Friedman was there, and Kasten talked, I guess, or maybe Kasten just talked to Dylan Hernandez separately of the LA Times. But you kind of can see how that conversation was going to go, especially based on the column Dylan wrote. Is it basically like Dylan going, "What about this? What about this?"
And
like,
side note, real quick, do you remember when Dylan was hired and he was just this, you know, spoke multiple language, straight nosed beat reporter, and then the ghost of T.J. Simmers has just enveloped him?
I can't say I did. Like, I know Dylan. I like know him personally, and like. He is like very good, like just in general, like at like cutting through the bullshit. Mm-hmm. And like, so like, I get where he's coming from a lot of the time, and he's not like disruptive, like asshole-y, like T.J. Simmers was in a scrum. But that said, he is like, but there's a difference between like, he's good at asking uncomfortable questions, but not inappropriate questions. So like, I have no problem with like his sort of,
it comes through way more if you see him in person too. I've seen video interviews with him, and it's the sort of, there's a levity to it that doesn't quite come through when it's all written down.
He's not bitter, bitter old man, like, you know, angry at the world type thing. But anyway,
sorry about that.
So that's okay. So, but yeah, so one of the things, like, so the new ownership group, when they came in, they're going to do what it takes to win, blah, blah, blah. They put a ton of money in infrastructure, you know, spending on, international talent, spending on the minors, making sure that gets propped up as they're sort of rebuilding the major league club. And that for, like we talked, there's 5 years where they paid $150 million in luxury tax. I think they averaged like 200 and some, I don't remember what the average was. I think it was like $250 million a year in payroll plus $30 million a year in luxury tax payments. So like, look, they walk the walk in that regard. And their plan always was, they said they wanted to build like a sustainable thing where the system is producing like, you know, talent, and either you capitalize that talent through calling them up to the majors, or you trade for major league pieces, things like that. And I think that's where they're sort of at right now. But the weird part about this is like the timing of it, I don't know if it's unfortunate for the Dodgers or just bad from an optic standpoint, is that they finally get to the World Series, right? After all these, like, they've won 6 straight division titles now, but like when they finally get to the World Series, and then they pick that offseason, which, mind you, at the same time, ticket prices have rose dramatically in that time. So like they're like trying to supply and demand says, like, that's, you know, they're, you know, look, they still sell a lot of tickets, and I get it. So there's a market there for those seats, but like you can get where the fans would get frustrated. But like, yeah, so they pick the time right when they get to their first World Series and come up one game short, and then to have like their least like active offseason. That said, it was a really good team. They obviously, it worked, like it got back to the World Series, but they lost again. But you understand where, like, why isn't the pushing all your chips to the middle of the table point now, right? Like, now you decide to, like, we're going to get under the luxury tax. Like, now is the time for restraint. Like, why now? Like, that. So I get why it's frustrating, you know, to fans. And it's, but it's like, you could see where the sort of plan was, but it takes a lot of, like, discipline, I guess, you know, because you have to withstand that, because you can't, it's like, you know, this is like a, you know, like a personal budget type of a thing. You have to like stick with it, or else there's going to be good months or bad months sometimes, you know, maybe income wise or whatever. But like, you're going to be like, well, this is a good month. I should square some of this away. But then, oh man, I really like those shoes. You know, it's not the same thing, but it's like,
And here's the thing is like, Bryce Harper certainly has the sort of longstanding pedigree as a great player, a star player. But at the same time, he is a left-hitting outfielder, something that the Dodgers just really don't need. And you can make the argument, and I think this is what Stan was trying to do, and he didn't do it in a very good way, and we'll talk about that. is, hey, we can only kind of breach that line, go 20, 30 million over the line once in the next decade. And we want to kind of keep that in our back pocket for something where we actually are badly in need of. Something that, you know, however it is 3-4 years down the line, could be an infield position where maybe some of the, you know, Justin Turner finally gets to the point where he's not productive anymore. You need a third baseman. Nolan Arenado is going to maybe become a free agent in a year. And they just don't think Bryce Harper's the guy to give that contract to. I can get the logic behind that. And it makes the brain ticks all the sort of the check boxes in my, you know, I'm playing baseball manager by myself. But it's not exciting. It's not going to put you over the top over these AL teams. And sure, maybe a year down the line, the Dodgers sort of offense is on the good half of things where they had been very, very streaky. And maybe they're on a good streak and they win, regardless of if maybe the talent level isn't quite there. But it's still, I understand the Dodgers' rationale, but I think I more understand the fans' emotional frustration over what's going on.
Right. And look, and the bottom line is this too, like, fans shouldn't care or shouldn't root for billionaires making more money. Like,
agreed.
Like, and on one sem level, even like, I don't even think fans should necessarily want their teams to be profitable, like in the cash flow sense.
And
like,
I am definitely giving the ownership a lot of leeway.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe I shouldn't of to make this team even. I think teams should be profitable. I think I'm going to slightly disagree there, but it should only be hopefully barely. And so I'm giving them a lot of credence that says, hey, if we go over this line twice in a decade, that actually makes us not profitable and makes us actually lose interest in maintaining ownership. Because generally I've enjoyed this ownership group, and I don't want to go back to the Fox, to the McCourts. I want them to be happy with the Dodgers as well. And if that means certain restrictions, fine. Because again, we are talking, oh, we're only going to go up to this threshold that whatever it is, five other teams go to.
Yeah. And like I said, we're just talking about this. There's, you know, I don't think either of us are like, you know, oh my God, I don't think we're carrying water for the owners. We're not at the same time. Like there's so many levels to this. Like, you, on one level, the Dodgers payroll, no matter how you slice it, is going to be like right around $200 million this year, maybe a little bit over, a little bit under. But like, on some level, you're like, how are you? You can't really be angry at that, like, you know, like on some level. But like, I get it. The thing is, the Dodgers left themselves, and this is their own fault. They leave themselves no benefit of the doubt. They have a TV deal that, you know, it's $8.35 billion over 25 years. So you just, like, look, doing the math, that averages. I know it starts smaller and gets larger, but over the 25 years, that averages $334 million a year. And that's before, like, any of the national TV contracts come in, which is, like, I think averages over just over $50 million a year. Last year, when MLB AM, Advanced Media, sold parts of their business to Disney, MLB, every MLB team got a one-time payment of, like, just over $50 million. And then this last year, the average salaries went down. So, like, owners are pocketing shit, you know, right now. And so you understand where the disappointment's coming from.
Absolutely.
But the Dodgers are on a TV network that, like, a lot of people can't see, because it's very frustrating. So they don't have a ton of the benefit of that, which is why I think some of the casting quotes in this story with Dylan Hernandez are frustrating, because it just seems so condescending. Like, and I, like I said, part of this is I wasn't there, so I can't speak to this, but just from what it sounds like in print, just doesn't make Kasten look very good. But like, so I'll say this, I'm just going to read a section of Dylan's piece here, starting with this quote from Kasten. It said, that's also such a weird narrative, Kasten said. If we can do whatever we do to stay under the luxury tax threshold, there are a lot of advantages to being under. By the way, a lot more advantages than you all write about. And then Dylan added in, such as, and then quoting Kasten again here, I'm not going to get into that because that's real inside baseball economic stuff. And so, like, right there, you're like, all right, guy. Like, for it was so, And then Dylan pressed him. He said, told fans would be interested in the details. Kez said, hold on, let me finish the answer. Some of the things are elsewhere in the collective bargaining agreement that no one's bothered to look at. Again, condescending. Some of the things are inside baseball. There are more advantages, just a little tax. So, look, I have the collective bargaining agreement. A number of, like, baseball writers on Sunday I saw, they're like, look, I've read the thing. There's not much in there. But so I think the two things are this is, like, when it comes to revenue sharing, like when teams pay into the luxury tax, like it gets spread among the non, the non-paying teams or whatever. But like, and if you stay under, you get a certain amount of credit. But like, it's so minuscule, like given the amount of, there are only two teams that paid in last year, so this is like a tiny thing. I think the major thing is that the Dodgers, like after 5 years of ownership, they didn't have like the leeway anymore on MLB's like debt service rule. So like in terms of their expenses relative to, you know, revenue, I think that's probably where most of this stuff is. But that's more of an internal baseball thing. But then it comes down to this, like while it's an ownership group, they have like they do have like minority investors and stuff. That's where they sort of have to make profits every year. And we've seen some of the leaked documents. excuse me, LA Times. Bill Shakin had a story a couple months ago where the Dodgers had like shown things to investors saying this will be our payroll for the next 5 years, and all of it was under the luxury tax. Again, these are. You're trying to make yourself look good, so maybe necessarily hold them to that, but like you can see where they're sort of coming from in this regard. And again, all well and good, but I think the way like Kasten sort of defended it, just he could have said so many things like to just make himself look better in that regard. And but in fairness to Stan Kasten, he didn't even say like. He didn't even like put his foot in his mouth the worst of any like ownership group or like front office people over the weekend. I'll get to those later, but so I don't know, man. Like I think they are still flexible, and like there's rumors that they're still involved in like Real Muto. I don't know. I guess we'll see. But that's sort of where the Dodgers are at.
Let's talk about the Russell Martin trade, and then that I think lets us talk about Real Muto a little bit.
Yeah.
So Dodgers, and we almost recorded over this, and we decided,
right. Dodgers, and part of it was a timing thing. We only had like, couldn't.
Do you remember? It was Russell's either rookie year or the year after, where the clamors to make him team captain. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I think it had to be. Man, it was no later than 2007, so that would have been his second year.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Back on the team, maybe. Can we make him team captain? You think that would go over well?
Man, who knows? It's one of those things, like, if Clayton Kershaw or Justin Turner aren't, like, team captains by now, like, they're just not going to do that anymore. I don't think teams do. But it is kind of weird, like, some teams, like, I guess not a lot of teams do this, but it used to be like a huge thing, like a big honorary title. And sometimes you get a C on your jersey or whatever. It's kind of weird. But anyway, so Martin's back. He's going to be, I think maybe he's 35 now. I forget. Apologize for the coughing. So they traded. This was like one of those like where the Blue Jays aren't really contending. So they're just getting out from under what they can. And the Dodgers traded two minor leaguers, Andrew Sopko, Ronnie Brito, for Martin. And then, like, Ronnie Brito is one of the guys we talked about, the huge infrastructure for the Dodgers. When they, in the big 2015-2016 international pool, they spent, like, over $46 million in international bonuses that year. And then by subsequently paid like almost $46 million in penalties. So that was like a huge sort of infrastructure thing. And Ronnie Brito was one of those guys. He got a $2 million bonus for signing. He's a middle infielder. I think he's showing up on some of the top 100 on the back end of some of those top 100 prospects this year. Minor league infielder, and then right-handed pitcher Andrew Sopko. They go to the Blue Jays for Martin, and then Martin's making $20 million this year, But the Blue Jays sent $16.4 million to the Dodgers, so the Dodgers are really only paying $3.6 million. But from a luxury tax perspective, which is, again, always a concern with the Dodgers now because they're up against it, that wipes out, like, his average. He signed a five-year $82 million deal with Toronto, so his average annual value is $16.4 million. So the cash the Blue Jays sent means that for the Dodgers' purposes, his luxury tax number is zero, which makes him, in many ways, a perfect player because he's relatively productive and he doesn't count against the salary, whatever. So, yeah.
So my question to you, with the, you know, there's the real Muto rumors, which were peaked right after the Pollock signing, and then sort of the Padres came in to steal a little bit of the thunder that maybe they're going to make a move for him, which makes zero sense, by the way.
Right.
Padres are weird. Anyways, Russell Martin, Austin Barnes, is that a Calvary at catcher you see world national two-time in a row National League champions going with?
Yeah, here's the deal with catchers where yeah, you look at on the surface. So Russell Martin, he's going to turn 36 the day after Valentine's Day. So this is his age 36 season. He hit 194 last year. So without saying anything else, that's where the Dodgers are at. Like, he's at least going to be the sharing time catcher. That said, he's always been able to get on base. He had a 338 on base, which is fine. He hit 10 home runs, but he had a 325 slugging. Again, a lot of that's driven by the 194 batting average, but pretty bad, 86 OPS plus. That said, given the state of catchers, he actually still ranks pretty good, like not terrible. And, like, if you factor in other stuff, like, he's actually, you know, above average framer. Pretty good framer, and, you know, he doesn't throw out runners like he used to, but, like, still pretty good defensively. So, like, he'll get the job done, but it's, like, it's one of those, like, they went from having a huge advantage at catcher in that Yasmani Grandal, for all his faults, was one of the most productive catchers in baseball, and now it's, like, you know, Russell Martin does a lot of things well, not terribly great, and then hoping for a bounce back from Austin Barnes, and, like, who's the majority, like, lion's share of playing time person there? You know, that's another thing. They're both right-handed. So it's not really matchup based, but, like, I don't really know right at this point. So you can see where the Real Muto rumors are rampant still.
Gives this front office a chance to make an actually exciting move.
Yes.
Say, hey, you know what? We don't think Bryce is the guy that, like, we're happy to give those contracts out. We're more happy to give them out to our own players. We don't think he's the one for it. It's not a position of – it's not a thing we desperately need. But here, we're gonna pay the King's ransom that the Marlins are wanting, or maybe somewhere in between. But we're willing to sacrifice for a two-year player because we want to contend, and we don't want to have that black hole in our lineup.
Yeah, exactly. So, like – you can see where Real Muto with Martin backing up is, like, ultra strong. Like, that's a really good catching unit. Whereas Martin and Barnes splitting time is, like, all right. Like, that, so that you can see where that's sort of a thing. But then, so going into, like, the Real Muto part of this, like, you can see where I think, like, Austin Barnes might be a part of that deal, or at least have to be moved at that point. Like, maybe not in that deal, but in some deal. Same thing with now that they got Pollock. Like, when the Dodgers talked about part of that Puig and Kemp deal was, like, sort of relieving sort of the pressure, or at least in the outfield. Like, they said, look, we had, like, six outfielders. It wasn't fair to anybody. Now they just have, you know, five outfielders. So it's, like, still, it's pretty crowded. So, like, you can see where Verdugo or Peterson, there's a lot of rumors with, like, John Peterson being bandied about. I could see it if they're, like, high on Verdugo, but at the same time, like, if a chance to get Real Muto, maybe Verdugo's in that deal. Or since you're getting 2 years out of Real Muto, and as much as we want to say, like, the Dodgers are waiting for, like, Kaber Ruiz and Will Smith, it's more Ruiz, I think, than Smith. But, like, is he good enough to like all of a sudden just hand the reins to in like 2020? So that I don't really know. So you could see a scenario where if they get Rio Muto, who's under contract for 2 years, or at least ARB eligible, maybe Ruiz or Smith would be included in that deal. So you could see sort of the framework of that deal sort of happening. It's a lot to ask, obviously, but at the same time, pretty good upgrade. So that I think that's where they're at. I have no idea if that deal is going to get done, but that's sort of where they're at.
I'm hoping for it. That's Pollock. I could take or leave, but Real Muto has been the guy that I've been hoping the Dodgers for a while. Although like, that, honestly, I got soured a little bit when Grandal took the deer he did. Like, as much as not a fan favorite as he had become, to offer him the qualifying offer and then go, oh geez, like less than a million more, never mind. Just seemed strange to me, but you know,
I do wonder
how much optics played into that.
Yeah, I think too, like you wonder, like, maybe he was ready to leave too. Mm-hmm, maybe mm-hmm. like they made it clear that, and like, so, because I know he said he got some multi-year offers and stuff. And there was one report that the Mets offered 4 years, $60 million. I'm not sure if that number is exactly right, but Grandal basically galaxy brained it into saying, look, I wanted to take like, you know, something fair for the players. And it's like, all right. If it was really 460, he probably should have taken that deal. But like, there was other rumors that like, you know, like 339, I think, from the Angels or something similar. So I get why he went the 1 year and like a higher number, but still weird. But yeah, and you wonder, like, who knows if he actually went back to the Dodgers and said, hey, I have a 1 year deal. Can you match it or something? Who knows? But like, so it is weird because as it stands, getting a catcher for 1 year or maybe two is like sort of what the Dodgers need for 2019. And then like to see Grandal just leave on a 1 year deal, it's like, oh, that's a missed opportunity. You're right. Very odd.
So you, coughing machine, did not go to FanFest this past weekend, right?
Yes, I missed it. Saw a little bit on TV, read some reports. Craig Benami was there for True Blue LA. But yeah, so I have a couple notes just of things that I saw that were sort of noteworthy.
Okay.
So I think the big one is Kenley Jansen said he's lost like 25 pounds. He said he's been working out like twice a day. And like, you know, getting in better shape. So that's good. Seems like a good, like he had the heart procedure and sort of, that's always a good sign, like for his like, long-term health. And to see that, like he looked pretty good. So that's a positive. Corey Seager, he's coming off of the Tommy John surgery. And then also he had a hip surgery later in the year. He like seems like he said all the right things, like in terms of he hasn't had any setbacks, so that's good. But he like stopped short of saying he'd be ready for opening day. And just given what we've seen, like I always like play the, you know, you sort of be cautious with these kind of things. So if I had to guess, I'd say he's not going to be ready for opening day, but they're going to, you know, take it slowly. And look, we've seen the last few years in spring training, there's always something. And Seager ends up playing minor league games for like 2 weeks instead of them bringing him to the major league side. So I think they're going to slow play him again and just bring him along at his own pace. But in terms of he's sort of checking all the boxes for now, but I think he's still got a long way to go. So then the other thing was new uniform numbers. Like
my favorite.
So I wrote a couple. So for one thing, AJ Pollock gets number 11. And I was going to make an Arizbel Arguena joke. You know, it's really Manny Mota's number, but then, like, you know, it was funny that Arguena got it a couple years ago. I had actually forgot that Logan Forsythe wore number 11. And I feel bad because, he's, like, really recent, and, like, I did not remember that. But anyway, so AJ Pollock's 11. Joe Kelly is 17. The Brandon Morrow number. So is he going to be an immortal every year? But anyway, Jaime Schultz, who another sort of fringe end of the 40-man guy that they got from Tampa Bay, he is number 50. Another pitcher, sort of fringe 40 guy they got from the Braves, Adam McCreary, is 62. For some reason, I can't find the list that are with these. Oh, yeah. So then a couple of the 40-man guys, Kaber Ruiz is 70. Matt Beattie is 72. I think Edwin Rios is 71, if I'm not mistaken. But and I, off the top of my head, I can't remember any of the new numbers. I think that's about it. But yeah, so that's sort of where they're at. I'm assuming Russell Martin, he was not a fan fest. I'm assuming he's 55.
Right.
So, yeah.
No real competition there.
Yep.
Well, that's all the notes we have. We remain this sort of, my head sort of understands what the front office is doing. My heart's not very happy. I really hope they make this trade with the Marlins. Again, it's not so much. We saw this in the Dodgers kind of before they made their World Series runs. Is a big issue is they just had a black hole part of the lineup where they had one or two guys that just could not hit, and how much that hurt them. And the last two seasons, the Dodgers have had the opposite, right? Top to bottom, just drawn bats. And I think that's a big thing they're going to need. And I really, really hope they get it, because outside of a miracle season from Martin or Barnes, catcher's going to be that hole. And there's a solution out there ready to be taken, and I hope they do it.
Right. And then the other thing, too, just I think we've talked about this before. So the Dodgers' second baseman as a whole last year, which was a lot of Forsyth, which was a lot of Chase Utley, and then other guys mixed in as needed, because they, you know, they have guys who play all over. But just as a whole, and then I forgot Brian Dozier also was terrible after they traded for him. So Dodgers 209, 307, 332 as a whole last year, second baseman. 30th in batting average, 29th in slugging, 19th in OBP. They did walk 79 times, which was third, but like the WRC plus was 78, so average being 100. They were very bad at second base. Now, you think, like, given the sort of constitution of the team or construction of the team, that the natural sort of order of things is like that Chris Taylor and Kiki Hernandez would see the lion's share at second base at this point and sort of leave the outfielders to the outfielders. I mean, they could also play outfield, but like, and then there's the thing where if Max Muncy's playing or David Freese are playing first and Cody Bellinger's in the outfield, then that's okay. But then like there's some cases where Dave Roberts keeps mentioning Max Muncy as potentially playing some second base. I can't see it for like a ton of games, but maybe some of those times when they just want to load up on lefties against a righty pitcher, and then you know you can sort of stomach Muncy at second base for a few games here and there. So I think that's what they'll do. But yeah, that's another thing where if they're thinking about like maybe move, but like I don't know what moves out there at this point. But like that's another thing where you could see an upgrade. But you're right about the black hole. Like that was a thing that hurt them last year, was production from second base. But if you have some production there, that's good. And then you have to address catcher still. So, yeah, it's going to be an issue, definitely, for sure.
Yeah, between especially CT, but maybe Kiki has a little bit of a bounce back year as well. Although he did better last year than I was now that I'm looking. Remembering, I think, the playoffs clouding my vision a little bit.
And he struck out a ton. Yeah.
And I'm... Eh, whatever. I don't care about strikeouts.
No, you're right.
I'm not that worried about second base. I guess that's one of the things. One of the pluses that I saw from the salary dump move with the Reds is getting those guys back in the second, not relying on sort of the failed attempts at. I remember one point where we're like, oh, we're going to get either Forsyth or Dozier, but it's going to be great no matter what. Second base is solved, and that didn't happen with either.
Exactly.
So hopefully you and I are recording next week with exciting news and going to break down the Dodgers' new catcher. That's my hope.
That would be good. Before we go, I have another Dodgers rewind to do. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Did you get the picture I sent of you of these two people? So we're going to do a two-for-one today.
Go for it.
So the Dodgers heading into the 1980 season, so 39 years ago, you know, this was like the infancy of free agency. Like, free agency was basically a new thing. Like, it didn't really take effect till like after the 76 season. So this would have been like the third year of actual like true free agency, but it was there. The rules were like a little different back then. They ended up, the two guys here are, excuse me, two pitchers, Dave Goltz, who was on the Twins, and then a reliever, Don Stanhouse, who was on the Orioles. They both signed big deals. So to give you a relative at the time, Dave Goltz signed a six-year contract for $3 million total. No, he didn't get the Kenta Maeda contract. It wasn't that bad, but like this was like a huge deal back then, to give you an idea of where baseball is at financially. Don Stanhouse got 5 years and $2.1 million total. Again, these were like huge sums at the time. They were like, oh my God. Like, I think Nolan Ryan in that same offseason, he got like $1 million a year, which was, and he was the first guy to do that. So that's where baseball salaries were at the time. And they were obviously about to like sort of explode. But so here from the Dodgers media guy, 1980, and the blurb about Colt said he, quote, became the first player to be selected by the maximum 13 teams in the first round of the free agent draft in the history of the draft. Again, this is only the third year of free agency, but what the hell is a free agent draft? Like, so I think what it essentially, what I begin reading about it, what it boiled down to me at the time, there were 26 teams. So they capped it at like, you basically like put in for guys you wanted. And then of that group, team people would bid on them. So it wasn't like an auction type thing, but it was their way to like figure it out. I don't know. So nobody at that point in the first years had all like the maximum 13 teams until Dave Goltz. So just looking at his sort of numbers, I don't know. He was pretty good. Like he won 20 games in 1977. He averaged over the previous 5 years, he averaged 15 wins a year. He had a 3.43 ERA. It was 1.15 ERA plus, which nobody knew about at the time. But like, he was actually a pretty good pitcher. It was weird. His 1979 season was like worse than his previous seasons, but like still pretty good. Like, he was like a workhorse guy, and the Dodgers said, "Look, we're going to go in. We're going to get this guy, and then, okay, then you'll see a pattern here." Neither guy particularly worked out too well. For one thing, who knows who Dave Goltz or Don Stanhouse was? So, but just going back, so on his 1982 Topps card, this was after 2 years with the Dodgers. The little blurb at the bottom said, "Dave's first two victories for the Dodgers were back-to-back shutouts against the Giants in April 1980. So those were like his third and fourth starts with the club. He was actually pretty good. But then after that, in that season, he had a 4.76 ERA in 140 innings. That was really bad. But to top what sort of made Goltz like the some more hated, I guess, was that the Dodgers that year, they swept the Astros in the last weekend of the regular season in Dodger Stadium to force a one-game playoff, similar to what they had this last year. And it was at Dodger Stadium, so it basically became a four-game series. The Dodgers, at this point, went with Dave Goltz to start 163. Mm-hmm. He was bad. He allowed four runs in three innings. The Astros were up 4-0. They won 7-1. So all that like comeback over the weekend was completely erased by the Astros beating them at home. But anyway, excuse me. The way legend goes, and because Fernando Valenzuela was so good, like basically for the next 7 years, was that the Dodgers screwed. This becomes like a after the fact Game 7 of the 2017 World Series thing, where the Dodgers clearly should have started Fernando, even though at that point he had never started a game, at least in the majors. He came up as a September call-up, and he was actually great out of the bullpen. He was probably like a better Julio Urias, like this last year. he gave up two unearned runs in September, but otherwise he was zero earned runs in 17 and two thirds innings. So like he was lights out from the start, but he was not really available to pitch 163, at least to start. This was like everyone who's saying, oh, start Kershaw, dummies, like, you know, because Kershaw ended up pitching four innings in relief. Although that in itself was like an amazing accomplishment because he had just pitched 3 days prior. Oh, and also he pitched badly. And then same thing about, what about Alex Wood on 3 days rest? No, that's not going to happen. But Kershaw, I mean, damn it, I did it again. So Valenzuela in that series when the Dodgers swept the three-game series, he pitched two innings Friday. He pitched two innings Sunday. There was no way, like, in reality, he was going to pitch again, or at least start again. He ended up pitching two scoreless innings of relief in that Monday game, but that's kind of what his role was. So anyone who says, like, oh, they should have started Fernando, maybe that's true. Or, I mean, it wasn't true, but maybe at least they should have started somebody other than Gould, but who knows. Stanhouse, on the other hand, was a reliever. His sort of notable thing, this is mentioned like throughout either both his baseball cards and in the Dodger media guide that year, which I have. But he said when he signed with the Dodgers, he said, I wanted to wear Dodger blue for a long time, and now it's a dream come true. But his time with the Dodgers was a nightmare. he was very bad. Like I think part of it was like arm trouble too. You know, he just, like, I don't know. He was not good. But just before we get into that, his nickname, which was mentioned on his baseball card, was Stan the Man Unusual, due to his unusual manner of getting in and out of jams. So, like, that tells you right away that, like, that something's like, man, we got to watch this guy. You know, like that should be a red flag. But anyway, so again, 5-year contract for Stanhouse. He pitched 25 innings in 1985, 0-4 ERA, really bad. But the thing that stood out to me was 16 walks in those 25 innings, 5 strikeouts. Like, what the hell? Right? How is that possible? But then if you look back, he actually, in his career, like, he walked 455 batters and struck out 408. So, like, including, like, the previous 2 years before the Dodgers signed him, he walked more than he struck out. He only had 5 fewer walks and strikeouts in 77. So I don't know how this guy was able to, like, considered good. Like, he did. He got in and out of jams and stuff. But, man, so anyway, he was hurt. He missed the whole 81 season. He was gone by then with the Dodgers. So 5-year contract, poof, done. But the best part, so his nickname, when he was in Baltimore, it wasn't Sandman Unusual, but Earl Weaver, he called him Full Pack because that was how many cigarettes he went through when watching him pitch. That's a way better nickname. Anyway, so to tie this all together, Gould and Stanhouse, again, early points of free agency, baseball was different back then. The Dodgers basically, like, didn't sign a free agent until, like, Mike Davis in 1987. So they went, like, 7 full off seasons after this. They're like, no, we did Gould and Stanhouse. We're good. Like, and like, you can go through. There's a few, like, minor things, but, like, these were, like, not quite minor league free agents, but, like, not impact at all. Like, they did not sign a significant free agent for 7 years because they were so scared away by Stan Gould, as people came to him. In sort of looking at this, I found an old LA Times article where, like, Rick Honeycutt struggled for a while after the Dodgers traded for him, but then he, like, sort of got into his groove a little bit and got better. And, like, Jim Murray wrote a column about him and said people were calling him Honey Gould. Because they that's how bad he was. So, like, the Gould-Stanhouse, like, tandem signings really, like, weighed on the Dodgers for, like, the better part of the 80s. But then also remember, this was, like, in, like, from, like, 86 to 88, or maybe it started a little before that. That's when there were 3 different times when the baseball owners were found to have colluded, and they had to pay settlements later to players, and players were granted free agency. That's how they just got Kurt Gibson, was because of collusion. Tim Raines is one of those guys. He was a free agent in 86. Nobody made offers to him, even though he was arguably like probably the best player in the National League at that point. So I'll give you this. There's a quote in December 1986 from the Dodgers from Fred Clair, who wasn't GM yet, but he was executive vice president. And Fred Clair's quote was, "We haven't stated a policy, parentheses, on bidding for free agents, but we are just not planning in terms of getting into the free agent market." Like, that's like, okay, like that's just a weird policy to have. It seems weird in retrospect, but again, it was a little bit of a different time. So that's very weird. But then to bring this sort of full circle, I mentioned like Kasten wasn't like the worst offender over the weekend. Neil Huntington of the Pirates, who have been like a weird team the last few years.
No kidding.
And their payroll is so low this year. They had like a team event over the weekend. I think the owner made like some weird like comments. I forget if it was Huntington or Bob Nutting, their owner. One of those two guys said, like, bragged about how the Pirates recently, because over like a 6-year span, they had like the 9th best record in the NL. And like, how do you say that with a straight face and pretend that's like a positive? But anyway, that's not his thing. But his quote, I'll just read you this from the Pittsburgh Tribune. Said, "When you sign a free agent, you have automatically outbid everybody else to get him 95-99% of the time. You have theoretically overpaid to get that free agent." So yeah, ownership's doing well right now. Like, or just, you know, front offices, like, maybe just don't talk about this anymore. Like, just it looks really bad. So people stay away from free agency. From the Dodgers standpoint, you could excuse me, sort of point it back to Don Stanhouse and Dave Gould. So that was sort of a two disastrous free agent signings 39 years ago.
So yeah, the Dodgers, you know, how bad can the AJ Pollock signing be?
Right. Imagine 7 years from now, you know, it'll be someone who's not Friedman or something, presumably, and just go, you know what, we're not into free agency right now. We don't have a policy. But
do during spring training, the worst free agent signings of all time for the Dodgers.
Oh man,
we'll have to compare them to Schmidt Jones, right? That's the sort of the next duo.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, yeah, though, obviously, yes. We should do that. I don't want to spoil the end of this podcast for that. But yeah, it's very weird. But so that's sort of where we're at right now with the off season. Who knows if there's going to be a significant move in between now and when players, pitchers, and catchers report. But
right before we sign off, Do you think there will be?
I think they're going to make at least one more like relatively significant move to the 40-man, whether it's adding or subtracting or just maneuvering. I think they're gonna do at least one more move.
Okay, I think it's.
And I think it'll be a trade. I think it'll be a trade.
Yeah, well, you and I agree then.
There it is. We're 100% on board. Congratulations, JT Realmuto of the Dodgers. So, on that note, we will talk to you next week about Realmuto.
Maybe.